Well, hello everyone. Thank you for being here tonight. It's really lovely to be here. It's such an incredible spot, and I'm really happy and humbled to be with Marin Sangha. Just knowing Philip Moffitt's work and the other teachers who have presented here. So it's really nice to be with you tonight. So thank you. My name again is Roy Reamer. And tonight I'm going to talk about suffering, loss, and death. But I promise you it won't be as horrible as it sounds. Maybe it's fitting to say just a little bit about myself. Back in 1997, after the death of my grandmother, with whom I was very, very close, I had the privilege of working with two people who were Zen Hospice Project volunteer caregivers. And I was working at a small Buddhist publisher at the time. And on our lunch breaks, etc., these two held space for me as I processed, really, my grief around that loss. And it was such a gift to me. And at the time, I remember wondering, what was it about these folks, you know, where they were so generous with their inquiry and their presence. And sometime in there, they shared with me that they were hospice volunteers. And they said to me, you know, just based on the way you talk about this loss, this death, you might be interested in this work. So I trained to become a volunteer caregiver there, and it was life-changing for me, truly. I had a career that I was happy with in book publishing, kind of minding my own business, and that work at the bedside of the dying really was an awakening for me. And so from 97 until 2010, I was a volunteer. For six of those years, I was a board member. So I was able to see the organization, the community, from a particular vantage point. And then in 2010, I began as a staff member at Zen Hospice Project. And that's been quite a journey as well. So perhaps fitting for tonight's talk, I wanted to share a little bit about what our community is actually going through right now. So some of you are likely aware that it's a time of great challenge and transition at Zen Hospice Project. Our beloved guest house that opened up to care for the dying in 1990 is now closed. June 3rd, we said goodbye to our last resident. And the hope was that eventually we could find a way to reopen. And more recently, due to a number of circumstances, the decision was made that we needed to sell the guest house. And this causes me great pain. I've learned so much in that place. And I've learned so much from so many of the people who died in that place. And one of the things that I've had to remind myself of in this particular loss is that we don't get to choose. We don't get to choose what dies away, what departs. And we don't get to choose when. And so today we had a gathering of part of the community, both the internal community and the extended community. And we came together and we said goodbye to this place.
Yeah.
And I know, because so many people have reached out, that this has this ripple effect throughout really the Bay Area, if not beyond. Yeah. So it's a huge loss. And I find my work in this loss is to simply pay attention to my own process, my own grief. And this is happening against the backdrop of so much loss around us. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that in many ways we've entered a period of what I would call Earth hospice, right? There is something that is really happening around us. We see it all the time with climate change, the fires, you know, the pain that people are suffering, you know, the accumulation of pollution, etc. And the big question for me is, as human beings in this time, in our time, you know, how do we show up for this? How do we show up for this? How do we not turn away? And how do we actually work to turn this around, but also prepare for the possibility that we can't turn this around? You know? So I find that in my travels, and it's probably true for each of you as well, you know, there's just so much grief in the field, yeah, around us. And I really want to honor the loss that is in this room and the grief that's in this room. This is what brings us together as human beings. It's what allows us to connect with each other if we really choose to acknowledge that in any given moment, you know, we're experiencing so much loss and grief, and we still carry on and experience joy and wonder at this amazing life. If anything, to really turn towards our own suffering and our own losses reminds us of how precious this life is, right? So let us enjoy it together while we're here. So, like you, I have a meditation practice. And it seems to me, in our meditation practice, we're really cultivating this ability to deepen our forbearance, you know, our ability to be with our own suffering. And this is quite useful if we choose to really turn towards our own suffering. If we choose to really acknowledge what's falling away in our lives and in this very body, you know. So this piece around suffering has become such an important practice, just simply to live my life, but I do view it as a way of preparing for my own death, actually. Yeah. We've all heard this saying, you know, we die the way we live, right? And each of us knows the way we cope with our own suffering, our own unpleasantries that arise in our life. Yeah. You know, some of us, we stay with it, we look right into it. We get really curious. And then others of us will turn away, we'll get busy. You know, we'll look for something to distract us. And I'd say for all of us, which approach we take kind of depends on what day of the week or, you know, what's happening during our day. Are we feeling particularly well-resourced or not? You know, well-rested? So, sitting at the bedside of so many people who have died, I've been able to really explore for myself how I meet suffering. Not just the suffering that's in front of me with the person who's dying, their family who is bereft, but my own suffering as well. For a long time, I had the joy of being able to participate in the new volunteer trainings. And we always encourage the volunteers, the new volunteers, to really pay attention when they're at the bedside. Are they trying to fix something, right? So are they attached to some particular outcome, right, in this person's journey toward death? The idea is that if they are, then they're actually bringing more suffering to the experience, right? So can they be with this person? Can they be with this suffering as a clear witness, so to speak, to simply bear witness? And this doesn't mean that we don't try to minimize their suffering by offering them a moist towel on their head or a sip of water or, you know, puff their pillow up for them. But this question, how attached are we to something, an experience being different than it is, right? Yeah. So someone was teasing me lately about, I was talking about the length of meditations and the pain it causes me in my legs. And they said, well, sit on a chair, you know. So, but in not any kind of, you know, masochistic sort of way, I like to sit on the cushion and experience a certain amount of discomfort so I can, you know, deepen this curiosity around how I meet the discomfort. How quick am I to move, change my position, you know? Or can I just sit a little bit longer? So when sitting at the bedside, it gets really, really messy sometimes, you know, with the heightened emotions, just with the smells and just the general discomfort, the agony that you might witness. And so just try to sit with it a little bit longer, another breath, you know. Just to stay and not turn away and recognize that, you know, this is what it means to be human. Yeah. Sooner or later, we find ourselves in this place. And can we find a way to even more than accept, but surrender to the experience? Yeah. So the question is, you know, how do we get there? It seems to me it's a lifetime of work. A lifetime of work. Yeah. So at Zen Hospice Project, we have what we call our mindful caregiver education. So for years, we trained volunteer caregivers. And we developed, some of you maybe have gone through that program, and we've developed this training that prepares people to sit at the bedside. And now we've taken it out to make these practices more available to people who are caregiving. I'm sure you're quite aware that in many ways in our society, there's a bit of a crisis of family caregiving. You know, many of us, sooner or later, all of us sooner or later, will be called upon to care for a loved one. And so many people find themselves in this position and they're simply not prepared for what it asks of them. So we're trying to teach some of the practices that we've used for so long as Zen Hospice Project to help them develop or cultivate greater resiliency in their role, right? So we hear this word a lot in healthcare these days, and it's wonderful, this idea of resiliency. You know, how quickly can we bounce back, so to speak, from a really challenging, difficult, painful situation? And this is a way that I would say we develop a sense of well-being for ourselves, right? And I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, know what I'm talking about, you know? Like we have a really difficult encounter. Someone cuts us off on the road. You know, do we carry that residue with us? Or do we, you know, bounce back quickly, let it go, right? This is really, really tough for family caregivers. Yeah. Because there's that the complexity of the emotions and the family patterns that have been established, but it's possible. So more and more these days, I'm sitting with this idea of. You know, how do we prepare for our own death? And, you know, I guess I would refer to this as an intention-inspired death, right? So what do we want our death to be when our time comes, right? And I want to be really clear that none of us knows the death that we're going to get. You know? If we're not careful at the guest house, it's this beautiful Victorian home, and people are in this place and they're being cared for and served by these incredible nurses and volunteer caregivers, and we get seduced into thinking like, ah, this is the kind of death I'm going to get. But we don't know, right? Yet, I find that for myself, by keeping my attention on the kind of death I want to experience for myself, it keeps me true in a way to my practice. Yeah. Not knowing what I will get or how I will react, it still seems like this really noble intention for myself to consider how I really want to meet this experience at the end of my life. Dying can, you know, be really, really difficult. It can be extremely messy. And, you know, certainly we don't want to add any kind of pressure on anyone to set an expectation for themselves. But nonetheless, I truly believe this is a really worthwhile consideration for those of us who are on the path of awakening. Right? What do I want that experience to be like? Yeah. So over the years, I've sat with people who are much better prepared than others to meet that experience. And, you know, we're living in a culture right now, and we saw this a fair amount at the guest house, where people don't really think about what they want at the end. And because we exist in this culture where we have such great faith in technology and medicine, that, you know, we don't really give ourselves, I've noticed for a lot of people who are reaching, who are dealing with terminal illness, often they don't give themselves the opportunity to really prepare for that that final experience of life. And this is quite understandable. They're so focused on medical intervention and doing everything they can to stay alive. Who wouldn't, right? But I do think there's a way that we can continue to explore every possibility to extend our life, to continue visiting with family and being around for important celebrations and occasions, and just hold on to life and prepare for our own death simultaneously. So we're not so surprised when our time comes. So how do we do this? How do we do this? In the classes that we teach, there's a particular module that I'm quite fond of, and we call this teaching piece Therapeutic Use of Self, right? Or Therapeutic Use of Self in Caregiving. And it's kind of a mouthful. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. So when we look at self, we differentiate between what I would call storied self, you know, kind of the ego story, who we are in the world, how we might introduce ourselves to someone, and then essential self, right? Maybe it's our true nature, our Buddha nature, our soul, spirit. There are so many names for essential self. And so we're trying to show caregivers how to do this dance, if you will, between the storied self and the essential self. And so why do we teach that? Some of the greatest suffering, I would say, that we witness at the end of life is when someone is just so attached to an outmoded sense of self, right? So in other words, they're having difficulty getting current with the experience of their illness and the reality of their approaching death. And so if we as caregivers can sit with someone in our essential self, so that very spacious quality where the story of who we are doesn't really matter so much, then it really gives permission for the one who's dying to enter into that space as well. And at the end of life, I think that's a really wonderful place to be, actually. It's that place where we connect to each other, you know, in this heart space, as simply two human beings. Now, for someone who's dying, it's extremely difficult to get there if you haven't gone through a process that celebrates the life that has been lived, right? That doesn't somehow make peace with, you know, the transgressions I've made, the mistakes I've made, my failures. And again, a thorough celebration and recollection and acknowledgement of the wonders of the life that I've lived. So another thing that we do a lot of at Zen Hospice Project is elicit, if you will, you know, life review stories. Like, we want to hear people's stories. Because the only way to kind of move beyond those stories is to really share them and to process them and digest them thoroughly. Yeah. So I think in our meditation practice, you know, this is another really lovely opportunity to just dwell or reside in that place of essential self. Yeah. And to, you know, do this dance depending on what the circumstances are. Yeah. To maybe recognize when we're overly attached to the story of who we are. I mean, we've probably all experienced this, where we really want someone to know, you know, who we are, what our experience has been. You know? But actually, when we're sitting with someone and connecting with them deeply, again, the story may not matter so much. Yeah. I remember being called up to the upper floor at the guest house. We had a gentleman living with us. And he was very agitated. And he was at a place where he was just about strong enough to get out of bed, but he was a fall risk, you know. And he had some place he needed to be. You know, this was a man who lived a life of really taking care of others. And he lived a big life. You know, he ran some company that he started. And he was a caregiver. And he was telling the nurses, I have things I have to do. I have to leave here. I need to get out of here. People need me. So this was going on for a while, and the nurses who were on duty, they asked me if I would come up and talk with him. And so I did. And I was able to sit down with him. And there was this moment, you don't often get this, I find, but there was this moment where I was able to say to him, I think you have some other greater purpose now in your life that's going to be of benefit to the people around you. They don't know how to do what you're doing. And here you are, you're doing it. And this is the way you're going to take care of the people around you. Because we're coming right after you. Our turn will come. So he calmed down a little bit. And you know, I could see him processing this idea that maybe, you know, this is what I have to offer now. Yeah. So I'm not convinced he didn't go back into that old story of having to take care of people the way he used to take care of people. But I certainly hope that it brought him some sense of purpose in this experience where so many people, they can't find any meaning in it. They can't find any purpose in the experience of dying. So that made a great impression on me. I'll tell you another quick story. Last night, I saw a friend, and I had not seen her since her grandmother died. And her grandmother had moved from another part of the country to come live out here with this friend of ours. And so in seeing this friend, I asked her, so how was your grandmother's death? And she said to me, she gifted me with her death. That was the way she put it. She gifted me with her death. And I said, wow, it's beautiful. Tell me more, you know. So she told us a little bit about the experience. And I asked her, so what did you learn from your grandmother about your own death? And she smiled. And she said, you know, so much, so much. She really made me think about my own death in such a completely different way. And, you know, she gave a couple examples about, you know, her presence and the kind of conversation she was willing to have about her experience. But to me, this was this wonderful example of the way in our dying experience, we make such an impression on the others around us. I mean, it's an obvious statement, right? Huge impression. But, you know, it offers us this opportunity to gift our loved ones with some little piece that may be useful for them when their time comes. Right? I hope that makes sense, what I'm sharing here. Yeah. So, some of the other work that I do in my life, some of you have heard of this, I'm sure. We call it Earth-based rites of passage. So I'm privileged to be able to take people out into the desert and guide them and support them in what we call a vision fast. Some cultures call it the vision quest. We don't use that term. But this is an initiation process for people. Most of the people who come and join us, they're marking something in their life. You know, maybe it's the end of a long-term relationship. Maybe it's the end of a particular role in their life. Whatever it is, they want to honor and mark this passage through some type of ordeal, some type of initiatory experience. So, over the years, what I've learned from my teachers in this work is that, and the anthropologists and sociologists who study initiation in different cultures around the world, they find that they all have these three stages. So the first stage is the severance stage, right? And the severance stage is you kind of leave your people, if you will, to go off and have this experience. Then there's the threshold stage. And so this is the actual ordeal of the initiation. So when we take people out, they go for 4 days, four nights, with no food. They take water, right? And a bare minimum of, you know, comfort things. No tent, but they'll have a sleeping bag, etc. So it becomes quite an ordeal. And the ones who have studied this practice in different cultures, they tell us that the more intense the ordeal, the greater the suffering, I guess you could say, the more transformative the experience. And so the third phase is the incorporation phase, okay? So this is when we return back to our community, to our people. And it's impossible to go back to your people without a gift of the experience, some learning, some teaching, some vision, if you will, right? And that's not ours to keep. We have to give it away. And this is how cultures throughout time, all over the world, this is how they've survived, right? Is that people have these intense experiences and then they learn from them. So I'm sharing all this because this is how I've begun to look at death and the dying process. It is the final initiation in a life of initiations, in a life of passages, right? So, if this is the case, and those of us who have supported loved ones or friends through death, we know that severance happens. Like, you know, we can sit with them, we can hold their hand, we can crawl into bed with them, but ultimately they are leaving us. They're leaving the community in not just in their death, but in their process of dying, right? There's so much inner work that needs to be done for the psyche to prepare itself for that last breath and that transcendence, if you will. So if this is the case, if this is an initiatory process, there is the severance stage, there is the threshold experience of the ordeal of simply dying, and then there's the incorporation into something that is just the great mystery. We don't know what that is. Maybe that's the incorporation back into the community of the ancestors. But that's just one way of putting it tonight, right? So what is the gift then that comes out of the ordeal for the sake of our people and our loved ones? Right? Does this make sense? So there has to be something, there has to be some gift that comes out of the absolute impossible experience of saying goodbye to your loved ones and your friends as you're dying. There has to be, right? So this is what I really want to encourage us to consider for ourselves. So the question that I would pose is, if there is a gift that you have to leave behind for your loved ones in your death, what is that gift? What would that gift be to them? Something that will help them not just live their lives, but prepare for their own death when their time comes. And then, how do you prepare yourself to fully give that gift when your time comes, right? For the sake of your loved ones. How do you prepare? So this is the question that I wrestle with in my life, you know, doing this work. And this is the question that I find really clarifies things for people when they think about the inevitability of their own physical demise, you know, their own death. So, today we offered a flower petal ceremony in saying goodbye to the guest house. And this is a ritual that we've been giving at the guest house for many, many years. So someone dies, and the mortuary attendants go up and they enclose the body and they bring the body downstairs, and we pause on the back deck, and the head is exposed, and we offer flower petals as a way of saying goodbye one last time and sending them off. And so often, you know, after we go through this ritual, the family already is talking about how their loved one did it, you know, what they learned. So, another question for you. In the deaths of loved ones in your life, you know, what is it that you've learned? What is it you've learned? What have you noticed? And I'll often ask the question, what did you learn about your own death in witnessing this loved one, this friend die? Yeah. So, as human beings, especially as human beings who have taken on a practice, you know, we do have this ability to live by vow, right? To live our life by vow. You know, in my experience, you know, I've taken on the precepts, and I've taken on the bodhisattva vows as a way to live my life. And we're able to live our life through intention. Like, what an incredible gift to be able to do that. To be able, sometimes my wife and I will say to each other, let's do this for our future self, right? So I don't think animals can do that, but as human beings, you know, we're able to do this. So this idea that we're talking about tonight is this way of, you know, living for our future self, living by vow, living for the intention of who I want to be in that moment when I say goodbye to this life. Yeah. Knowing that we don't know what kind of death we're going to have, you know. Some of us will go suddenly like that. Others will linger and hang on for long times. Some of us will, rage against the fading light, right? We don't know. But in some ways, that doesn't seem so important. It's more about how are we living our life today, right? What are we doing today to prepare ourselves? So cultivating a relationship to death. And in taking on this work in my life, it has this way of just clarifying things. It makes life so precious, because we keep death close. And, you know, we live still, things are beginning to shift, it seems, but we live in this culture that doesn't really want to deal with death. Like, we have our ways, you know, the macabre or you know, sensational video news movies where, you know, it's so big, but to really place death in a place of honor on the altar of our life, we don't really do that very well in this society, right? So by keeping this, or coming up with this intention for ourselves, for the end of our life, I think places death in that place of honor to inform us in the best possible way. Because we never know, yeah, how quickly death may come for us. Yeah. So I would love to. I must apologize. I'm, as I said before, it's my first time here. And I started to think we're going till 8, we're going to 7:50, so I'm going to stop talking, and please, I would love to hear from any of you on how this lands for you, you know? Yeah, any thoughts that come up? Anything at all? And I guess it's a custom to use this, so I'll let you turn that.
Reminded me of the two people close to me that I went through their deaths with, and this was a long time ago, like over 10 and 20 years ago, my grandmother and my father, and that it was so much more full and rich and a process with the two of them, because I had a year to get used to it, a year of visiting them regularly, even though they both lived really far away. I went to see them every 3 or 4 weeks. And I went through all of, I felt like I went through all of my grief up front. You know, all of the raging, all of the, I'm going to be an orphan now, all of the peacefulness, all of the whatever I could offer, so that when they finally passed, you know, there was that, but I'm not really one. And then there was the relief. Yeah. And that was in contrast to my aunt, who died very quickly and unexpectedly and very tragically young at 67, and she got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and in 2 months she was just gone. And I thought I had a year. I almost missed her. I almost didn't get to say goodbye because it was so crowded. She had a billion friends and everybody, and then the family got really creepy and awful and said, stay with me. I knew I'm coming anyway. So I had 5 minutes to say goodbye to her. And the ripple effect of the garbage, because that side of the family didn't come together in a good way, and I didn't have access. It was just, it was so different. And I've come to my acceptance with it, but it was, you know, for years I was like, why did I get shut out, and why are they being so mean to me, and my own sadness that I hadn't gotten along with her for 10 or 15 years, even though she was a wonderful person, she could be really difficult. And I was just beginning to come back, and so there was just so much more that was a result, and I really get that in whatever way you can show up and be with the person, whatever time you have, is so important.
Thank you. Yeah, what a contrast in your two stories. Yeah. Thank you. I thought you were going to choose right here. Yeah.
This will just take a second, so then I'll pass it to you. I just want to recommend an app that you can get. You can download it on your phone for free. It's called We Croak. It has quotes on dying and death.
Beautiful. We Croak. Yeah.
It comes all day long. You can look at it as often as you want. And they're all brand new every day. There's a whole bunch more.
That's great.
We Croak. C-R-O-A-K.
It's just like Croak. C-R-O-A-K.
So I just wanted to say that I have sometimes found the thought of my own death to be quite liberating. The fact that, well, the crap that I'm going through on any particular day, like a bad traffic or something, but all of a sudden seems very inconsequential. I remember that sort of the equivalent of in 50 years, nobody will, you know, it won't matter anymore. Well, you know, it might even be 5 years, but it's nice sometimes to remind myself that this will pale in comparison. Mm.
Thank you. Yeah, so true.
So thank you. And I want to say I love that you mentioned the earth. And I love that you used the word vow. Because I made a vow when my dad died a long time ago. And it's been really helpful. And I made another vow when my mom died 5 years ago. It was just 5 years ago. And that has really changed how I'm looking at things. And so it's been really nice to, if I remember nothing else, I'm going to remember live by now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. There's a comment here. Yeah.
Would you challenged us to come up with a gift. Where I went to was thinking about a gift that would both facilitate the transition of dying as well as living, and I went to being at ease, with all processes, both living and dying.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. I think there was one more, and that takes us to 7:15. Two more.
And we don't hold to that strictly, so.
Okay.
7:15.
Great. Good. Thank you for that.
Going back to this essential self, and sitting with your essential self, and what you said about it's difficult to do if you've not reconciled the transgressions in your life.
Mm.
And for me, it came up that I think I'm very attached to those transgressions.
Mm.
But I don't want to forgive myself those. But they just, and perhaps because I haven't shared them, I tend to keep them very close, that I feel like they're unforgivable.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'll never forget. a woman who I sat with as she died at Laguna Honda Hospital, where we serve our volunteers. And I had spent enough time with this woman to know that she had some deep, dark regrets and secrets. And, you know, the best you can do is kind of hold space for her to then offer. But that night, sitting with her, you know, people talk about hell. I felt like she was experiencing a hell realm. She seemed so burdened. So, I just offer that story, you know. Yeah, so I wish you well and the best with that. Yeah. And we work with these wonderful precepts that our founding director, Franco Soseski, first articulated. He now calls them the imitations, but we still refer to them as the precepts. And, you know, one is don't wait. So that is my wish for you. Don't wait. Yeah.